Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft. Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft. Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft.
Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft. English 115F, Fall 2007, Vanderbilt University. Professor Jay Clayton, Professor Matthew Jed Hall. Visit our class blog at worldsofwordcraft.wordpress.com.
I will be happy to read and regrade your paper as many times as you want to rewrite it. So I'm a firm believer that writing is a process and that we're here learning how to write, not evaluating, you know, completed one try, completed documents. So if you want to rewrite your paper yet again, I'm happy to read it again for a new grade. But I have to give you the grade that is my honest assessment of where that piece of writing stacks up in relation to the kind of expectations you're going to face, not just at Vanderbilt, but in the world at large. So I know many people are good writers at a high school level, and they feel a kind of shock and disorientation when they get to this next level. It's like gaming. You know, it's like taking your character into a really tough region. You've got to learn to deal with the pressures there. So when I say I'll regrade it, I do not mean that you make a few adjustments and correct the few things that I've commented on and call that a rewrite. Correcting a paper is not a rewrite. A rewrite is massive reconception of large sections of the paper. If there's not two pages of entirely new text in the paper without making it any longer. Several of you went on to the sixth page, and I always commented, don't go over the page limit. But I didn't count off for it this time around. My dissertation director, I'd turn in a paper in graduate school that was too long, you know, say it was a 20-page paper, and I'd write to 24 pages, he'd tear off the last four pages without reading them, wad them up, throw them away, and right at the bottom, why does this paper end in mid-sentence?
That is beautiful.
So I didn't do that to you. Maybe since it's such a positive reaction, I should have. But I sure can. As you'll see, when I return them on digital Dropbox, I make a new file that says the name of your paper graded, and send it back to you. And I could delete all past the fifth page and then say, why no conclusion? So if you intend to rewrite a paper, it means new writing. It means recasting the paper in such a radical way that there are at least two pages of new prose throughout the course of the paper, not just, you know, you cut two pages off the end and write a new two pages, but everywhere you need to rewrite, you need to rethink and rewrite completely. If you do that, I'll read it again for an entirely fresh grade. I won't even average the grades. I'll go for a fresh grade.
What if it's worse?
And if it's worse, if it's worse. If it's worse because you haven't done any work on it, I'll take the lower grade. If it's worse because it's just, you know, you have worked hard and it's still worse, I'll keep the existing grade. Yes.
When should we do this by?
You've got, you know,
tomorrow?
During your life at Vanderbilt.
It's a nice deadline.
It is a nice deadline.
Like at Vanderbilt, like after this class is over and we have grades are entered, we can do it.
You know, it won't change the grade at that point, but it will improve you as a writer. And that is my goal, is improving you as a writer. Not, you know, I'm not a, unlike my co-professor, I am not a policeman. It is not my goal to enforce improvement, but it is my really passionate goal to make you a better writer. Yes.
So, like, we could rewrite one of our papers over Thanksgiving?
You could indeed.
Okay.
You could indeed. Because I want you to get to be a better writer.
Guys, and I'm telling you, whatever walk of life you're in, it's going to serve you very well.
Yep. So, that's my speech about grading. Today we're going to plunge right into Snow Crash. Professor Hall is going to take over from here, though I love this book so much that I'm not going to resist talking a lot about it.
Well, I thought we had had a wee bit of a chat of discussing tying up the loose ends from the previous discussion around point of view and intertextuality.
No, let's go with Snow Crash. I want to do that later when I have more time.
Well, let's start with a brief verbal quiz. What is a deliverator? Do not blurt it out. I want to see hands that I don't normally see. Deliverator.
A deliverer of speedy pizzas.
Deliver speedy pizzas.
Really speedy pizzas.
30 minutes.
Okay, who knows the name of the university where one trains to become a really excellent deliverator?
Isn't that Cosa Nostra Pizza University?
No. Yeah,
what is the significance of Cosa Nostra? Since we just watched Goodfellas, a little bit. What is the significance of Cosa Nostra in this book?
Max says it's not Cosa Nostra. Yet.
No, I was shaking my head because I haven't seen Goodfellas.
Well, you saw a snippet of it last
week.
Yeah.
So what's the significance, Wesley, of Cosa Nostra?
It sounds Italian, and that's, speaking of mafia, that's all I can say.
So Tasty Pizza and Italians go together, right?
No, it's mafia and Italian go together.
Mafia and Italians go together. We shan't stereotype.
In fact, we're going to edit this broadcast.
Stereotype can be a
in our intellectual discourse, we can explore those topics.
Can it be a literary device?
Actually, that's a good point. Stereotype can be a literary device. Mm-hmm. And it plays a big role in this book.
Well, on Wikipedia it says the Mafia, also known as Cosa Nostra, is a Sicilian criminal secret society which was first developed in the mid-19th century in Sicily. So,
let me take the Wikipedia reference in addition to Cosa Nostra and bring this together. Why is Wikipedia relevant to Snow Crash?
It's like the library.
Well, we had a conversation about Borges and the library and how the library morphed into something very different that he conceived. And when was Borges writing this Library of Babel?
1942.
Now that's a bit, we're in the book.
41.
The book's 92. We're talking about Borges now. So you had a guy in the 1940s conceive of this circularity, this infinite library where people explore things and they're all linked together. This is part of a long line that we're leading to two authors here. William Gibson and Neal Stephenson are very important. What's the name of this genre of literature?
Science fiction.
Well, let's go. That's true. This is true. But I'm going to offer two things here. Yes, it's science fiction, but I'm also going to offer this may very well be something known as speculative fiction. I'll ask Professor Clayton if he wants to make a distinction in those two areas. And then there's one further kind of subgenre that I want to mention that I'm really looking for in the question. Did you want to talk speculative fiction briefly?
A lot of science fiction writers over the course of the 20th century, I'd say particularly from 1960 onwards, wanted to rename their genre from science fiction to speculative fiction. And they liked that name because they could keep the SF initials for it. And speculative fiction, they thought, was a broader category that could include fantasy, could include more experimental writing, and didn't have to be restricted to what used to be called hard science fiction. The term hard science fiction was invented back in to characterize the science fiction of the late 30s and early 40s and still existing today.
I think Larry Niven would be.
Larry Niven's a great example. Early Arthur C. Clarke, early Robert Heinlein.
Pulp fiction.
Much of the pulp fiction was divided between the hard fiction that John W. Campbell first started publishing in his pulp science fiction magazine in the 40s and monsters and aliens and fantasy works as well. So that may have been more than you wanted.
No, it's actually a wonderful conversation because now we're in the process of refining. So the science fiction genre is getting more refined. There's a speculative fiction. There's a particular category within science fiction that I'm looking for here.
Cyberpunk.
Cyberpunk is the name.
Exactly.
These two authors that I'm mentioning really exemplify this genre. I mean, they probably define the genre. Now, let's go back to the library. The reason why I said speculative fiction is because I think Neal Stephenson here. When was the book published, Jeff?
1992.
I want to give Jeff. He answered it earlier, so I wanted to give him an opportunity to re-answer. 1992. When was the internet really born? Anybody have an idea?
1996. know where it was born.
The universities.
It's ERN. Right?
It's BBN. Albert Beranek. But the real issue is 1994 is kind of a demarcation point that I use. Right? Before that, when William Gibson was writing his book called Neuromancer, which is about a computer hacker named Case. Case is also a computer acronym for computer-aided software engineering. But there wasn't an internet when he conceived of it. There was not an internet when Borges conceived of the library in this manner. Neal Stephenson was on the verge of the internet revolution. Everybody's maximum dial-in capability was 56 kilobits per second. Our rates here on the wireless, who knows the wireless rates generally? Anybody know? 54 megabits per second.
Well, but you never get that.
But it's a huge difference. I mean, think about where we are today, and these guys are riding in a world where speeds are different, and they couldn't conceive of it. Jay, can you flip me over to the other area? So the library that was conceived in Borges, inside of Snow Crash, there was a merger that had occurred. Two organizations merged to form the CIC. What's the CIC?
Central Intelligence Corporation.
The CIA and
Wesley, say it again for the microphone.
The CIA and the Library of Congress.
So intelligence in libraries.
No.
Intelligence and intelligence.
Yeah. They're coming together. And here's an interesting thing, perspective-wise, in terms of the predictive power of Neal Stephenson and Gibson. Today, you guys are working in a model called Web 2.0. This is from a world where there was a publisher that broadcast material to you from an editorial board and a group of experts that had to certify, you know what, my knowledge is valuable. You have to go through a printing machine that owns the distribution of your knowledge. Today, you can blog. We went through this last time. You are publishing, so now you are participating in it. What's the significance of CIC? Chris brought up the Wikipedia statement. Why is the CIC relevant to Wikipedia?
Because anyone can put stuff in there.
Just like anyone can input into the library.
What was Hero Protagonist? And who's Hero Protagonist, by the way?
The protagonist.
What was Hero Protagonist's profession?
Hacker, freelance.
And what else? There's another.
The greatest sword fighter in the world.
Greatest sword fighter in the world. We don't want to forget that one. So you don't want to be on the business end of the swords. So,
quick question. Do you think that he influenced that movie, Kill Bill?
Without a doubt. Even if it was subliminal, I think so.
Okay.
So you've got this predictive capability, as Chris said. Now it's participative. The CIC, Hero Protagonist, Wikipedia. Did he prognosticate the wiki movement and the blog movement through the CIC? What to explain? Talk about the CIC and some of the evidence you may submit into that discussion based on what you read.
You don't need to be a verified source, really, to put stuff into the CIC or Wikipedia. You can just be anyone. Like an individual can just update a file.
Was there something about Ukrainian fuzz grunge?
Yeah. His roommate is like in one of those bands, and he started uploading a bunch of sound clips and stuff because he thought it might catch on, but
not yet. Do you think that blogs have the power today to influence?
I think they do, but it's becoming so widespread. Like, it's hard to, for me, it's kind of overwhelming whenever I want to look at a blog, because how do I know which blogs are going to have the best material and which blogs are, because there's so many.
Right.
So like, I normally just read my friend's blogs.
Well, I think that was some of the point that he was making inside the library. The library diminished in a lot of respects. But why did Borges say that you needed guides in that library?
There's so much junk. The gargoyles are always floating up. I was largely useless stuff.
You had to sort yourself out. There was another interesting prognostication inside the book. General Jim's, help me out, guys, defense.
The army, the defense.
Yeah. What was happening in society in this speculative world?
The police systems were commercialized.
What do they call suburbs? What did they call suburbs?
Burbs.
Burbs. Now, what was there, was like in the way state of Tennessee organizes itself in law enforcement, there is a state law enforcement authority. Every county has a sheriff. That's the constitutional law enforcement officer of a county. From that derives your municipal power. So, was there a similar law enforcement structure? Seth, what was the law enforcement structure in a Burrclave?
They had their own system, their own jail.
What was the name of that standardized, you can, how he ended up in the pool? The standardized layout. I can't remember the name of it.
It was like an acronym, like five letters.
Yeah, it was really a suburb-esque sort of.
That's the name of the neighbor, the Muse at something Heights.
Yes.
Like the M and
the Muse at Arlington Heights, or what is it? Do you remember it, Jay?
MWA Arlington.
Do you see all the things that he is hitting on? He's talking about cookie-cutter suburbs. Have you guys driven around the counties? I don't know where you live and where you're from. I know where we're from in Texas. We saw Plano looks like Richardson, looks like everything else. You can almost interchange it. The law enforcement elements are privatized. So is that happening today? Can you think of a way that it's happening in society today, where General Jim's defense contracting is happening in today's world?
There's private security, like
where?
VUPD. I mean, they have Blackwater.
VUPD is a law enforcement agency.
Well, there's private security.
They're sworn off.
At the frats, they always
have. I'm just saying they're separate from
this. Okay, we're having several conversations here, all of them relevant, so let's get them out. Go ahead.
Oh, at private security, all the fraternities have security guards on the weekends.
Yeah.
Is that your birthday?
Sure. Sure. We have private security basically fighting a war.
What was the name of that? What's the name of that firm?
Blackwater.
Blackwater. That's the one I wanted to go.
Huh?
He predicted the internet, the state of Wikipedia. He predicted Blackwater.
Mercenaries.
Yeah.
General Jim's was a mercenary. What? My point in mentioning all this isn't to explore the wonderful sociological and internet phenomena, but to say that he was in a timely place when he wrote this. And I think he not only nailed descriptions very well from a literary perspective, he took all these, we've had this postmodernist discussion, the various sociologies, anthropologies, technological studies, and he wove it into a wonderful tale.
I want to go expand our term prediction, which is absolutely right, but expand it into imagining the possible consequences of all this. He didn't just say, oh, we might have this technology or we might have that technology. You got a comment along those lines?
Well, I was just going to say that I'll give him the Wikipedia prediction, but on mercenaries, I mean, there have always been mercenaries.
Yeah.
There always be, well, I don't know if there will always be mercenaries, but
Probably.
As far as we can see, I'm sure there will always be mercenaries. And I think it was more, I think it is sort of a commentary on if capitalism really does exist. I'm not talking about our quasi-socialistic capitalism we have today. I'm talking about like Adam Smith, invisible hand, hardcore capitalism. He's talking about like if we go down that road, then we're going to get to the point where, you know, the government's going to become the CIC, which is just sort of another company on itself. And
but great stock options.
Mr.
Though.
Lee's and stuff, they all just have their own privatized little mall-sized countries all within the United States. It's sort of a warning of what pure capitalism could become, I think.
So it's a great comment. I mean, what is the difference? Of course there's been mercenaries since the dawn of time.
Well, our Prussians helped us out quite a bit, didn't they?
Well, it goes back to Greek and Roman. They had mercenaries then. So what? But you put your finger on a huge difference, and particularly in bringing up capitalism. I think that's great. Flesh it out. More comments on that?
Jonathan, Mike, back there at the end of the table. What do you guys think?
Oh, what?
Yeah. What's happened to the federal government? I think this is part of where you're going.
That's exactly where I'm going.
Why don't you take it back over?
No, please.
No, you do it.
Wait, in the book?
In the book.
In the book, yeah.
Oh, it's basically gone.
Yeah, yeah. It's given out most of its power.
It's been
decentralized.
Michael?
It's privatized now.
Yeah.
Decentralized, privatized, given up its power.
It's almost like corporate anarchy in the source.
There's two other contemporary authors. I mean, Philip K. Dick is another one who explores this idea. How many seen Blade Runner?
Dang it.
I'd really urge you to see Blade Runner.
Do you watch
Strange Days?
That's
Strength
a story. But this, so I heard the words decentralized? Help me out again.
Privatized.
Privatized, outsourced. Is the federal government defunct? Come, just jump on in, Wesley.
Oh, well, did anybody go see Ben and Jerry? Speak.
Yeah.
Yeah. Part of their emphasis was how all the lots of power has been turned to the corporations in our and business in our, I mean, in our country. Even today, it's being taken off of the government. The government doesn't have most of the power. It's mostly controlled by, you know, our fiscal system, all the business that goes on. And I mean, I think that's true. That even now, what he's predicting is happening. You know, where the business takes over, it's starting to happen now. And it's just uncanny how it's picking up like that.
So he predicted a social phenomenon. I don't think in any short period of time the U.S. government's going to fold and sell itself out to Walmart.
Mm-hmm. Who knows?
But we see pieces of it where they are outsourcing a lot of their function. They're giving up sovereignty. One of the big issues around Blackwater, those of us who are in the military had to be subject to a law within the military called the UCMJ. That was our Universal Code of Military Justice. We had certain things that we had to do. Blackwater didn't. And when the government was relieved of its sovereignty in those roles, roles of engagement, command, accountability change. And I think that's what is the issue here, because at the end of the day, people drive fast. What's the term that they use for minivans, largely?
Bimbo boxes.
Bimbo boxes.
So we're talking about stereotypes. Why bimbo box? What do you think you came up with that term?
Moms trying to...
Yeah, with their kids.
I think he has a disrespect for all that is standard and... you know, everything. All the people who drive minivans are the same old factory workers, and they're all conforming. It's the bimbo boxes because they're conformed to what everyone else is doing and to the, you know, the pattern of living in a burp clay and having a good family.
But at the same time, it's not Stevenson who's calling them bimbo boxes. It's YG and all her like skater friends, the 15-year-olds who are just riding around. They're couriers there. Hip and they're cool, and their teenagers call them bimbo boxes. So, I mean, we all hate when we have to drive our parents' minivan. Does anyone, you know, drive their parents' minivan? And friends make fun of you for it? Like, we're at that level, too.
They're
so.
Calling us the blue bomb.
I just say
didn't hear us calling bimbo box, too.
But, I mean, you're really right. You're emphasizing point of view.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily Neal Stephenson, but what he's doing is constructing a world. And part of the way he's constructing a world, which is a very imaginative world about the implications of capitalism gone wild, the withering away of the nation state, the transfer of functions to private corporations, may be the rise of stereotyping. Professor Hall mentioned accountability in the military, but there's accountability in society as well.
Absolutely. You know, technological predictions here as well. Who brought their books today? Raise them up high. This is a literature course. You said we're supposed to bring our books. Ted, turn to page 24. I want us to get a definition read.
Yes.
I believe it's a top paragraph. Jay, help him out.
Yep.
There's a definition of the metaverse there.
Okay.
I want your lovely reading voice for this.
So heroes.
All right, so Hero's not actually here at all. He's in a computer-generated universe that his computer is drawing onto his goggles and pumping into his earphones. In the lingo, this imaginary place is known as the metaverse.
Hero does what?
Hero spends a lot of time in the metaverse.
You want to read the rest of it?
It beats the shit out of You Store It.
I figured we'd get that on tape for Mom.
Way to go, Ted. All
right.
Well, but it does beat the heck out of a You Store It. I'm going to edit and politically correct it. It beats... What's wrong with a You Store It? It's a lovely environment. He said he's got a nice little view. Sequoia every once in a while ruins his sunset.
Well, it's a place where people used to, like, throw their crap, and it's like metal walls, like an aluminum siding door. Like, it's nothing good.
Former chemical dump, perhaps?
Yeah.
So, I mean, where would you rather be?
Metaverse.
And like a sweet neighborhood with all your friends.
Okay, so wait. Whoa. The juxtaposition of those two comments really raised the class issue that is underlying a lot of this. Your response is, I won't even say your name out over the internet. Your response is, I just live in a sweet neighborhood where the rich people can live.
Well, with my friends. Not
and with your friends, rich. That's right. You don't want to be alone in your rich neighborhood. What about a hero who can't afford that sweet burb clave that you long for?
Then he goes in the metaverse and he has a neighborhood with all his hacker friends.
His cave.
The cave of the metaverse. Good work. That's
do we
nice.
Know anyone in the? Do we know in our personal lives anyone who resembles that reality?
Yes.
Someone who carries around samurai swords.
If you do, Jim,
and lives in a used store.
If you do, I want to put a warrant out on him right now. So you let me know.
So that's a no.
And that, if we use Jeff's terms, yes. But I think, do we know anybody who would rather be there than a used store? Than their used store, whatever their used store is.
We used to practice rowing. They have rowing machines called ergs, and we stored all our ergs in a used store place, and we didn't want to take them down to the lake, so we just practiced at the used store at like 6 at night, and there were guys next to us who were a heavy metal band who just had their amps there, and they were practicing heavy metal while we were practicing rowing.
So there is a vibrant youth culture
around the youth store.
It has begun.
So Peter and Jeff are going to take a leases out on about 20 youth stores.
It's also really the end of the recent movie version of iRobot, a vast historic complex.
But do you know anyone who would prefer to live in the metaverse versus our reality?
Our metaverse is our internet isn't as realistic as the metaverse. You can't become completely immersed on your video screen like you can if you had the 3D image around you with just your goggles.
So no WoW players spend more than 3 hours a week playing WoW, do they, Whistle?
I'm not saying that they would.
They do.
You're taking one thing I said and bringing it.
Wesley, come on.
Say my name again.
I'm going to, Wesley.
I'm not saying that people don't spend a lot of time on the internet, but I'm not. It's not as a complete escape as Heroes.
So it's a partial escape, not quite approximating the wonderful technology that Hero has.
It's not complete. Like
so more Heroes. Like a public terminal.
If you change the name from Halo 3 to the Metaverse, then I would rather spend most of my time in the Metaverse.
Until you die.
Yeah, but there are respawns.
Is there a respawn in the Metaverse?
Every 3 seconds.
Actually,
part of the plot is the invention of, I won't say exactly what they do, because I don't want it, but there is an invention that they make where you can die for real in the Metaverse.
Yeah.
And that becomes... leads to the culminating, let us say, samurai fight of the whole novel.
Well, Wesley's talking about the maturity of the technology today versus what it implies there. There are other technological differences between our Halo 3s and our Second Lives and Lord of the Rings Online. There is a persistence about the metaverse. People, and when I say persistence, you can touch it, you can modify it. In Snow Crash World, you can modify the metaverse. Mm-hmm. Now, when they talked about here, where was Hero's formative role in some of his cohorts? What's his formative role in the metaverse?
Yeah, he helped design the bodies, and also he helped sort of create that place.
What did they call the bodies?
Avatars.
As far as I know, I've looked for this. I haven't been totally thorough in my searching, but as far as I know, that was the first use of the word avatar for an online character. That's pretty cool.
There's a lot of firsts in this vocabulary.
Max had his hand up. Have we gone too far away?
No, it's sort of, it's not related to specifically what we're talking about, but I read an article a while ago and just found out online there's this site called secondlife.com, which is the metaverse, just
maybe
not
you could upload Second Life.
Exactly the same.
Isn't that what you were referring to?
Is it exactly the same?
Well, except for like how high tech it is and reading your facial expressions, but in 50 years the Second Life could be
I think that was the aspiration of Linden Labs, the producer of it. Max hit it. That was their aspiration, was to be the metaverse. Yeah. It clearly came straight out of there. It's a great illustration, Max.
and they call them avatars.
Yes, they do.
You can build in it. You can purchase property and build in it.
You can. There's a lot of real economic activity around Second Life too.
And that's where did Hero's buddies make their money?
On Metaverse.
It was Black Sun, wasn't it? Was that the name of
that?
Oh,
yeah.
Because my friend,
they bought real estate.
He did community service playing Second Life. He's really big into Second Life, and he runs a store, and all of the purchases, real life purchases, are like made for donations, and every 6 months he makes like $400 and just, you know, puts that in his community service hours. And it's real money he's making playing this video game. It's pretty cool.
Like Wilcho, are they trying to say gold?
Yeah. I have like 9 names as my ignore list from, hey, check out this site.
No, no. You can report them. You can report them.
How do you report them?
You hit the help, and then one of the options is new tickets. Hit that, and you can get an option for spam. Then just type the name in and say spamming for gold and report them.
They just delete
the person.
They just need a new account. Yeah, but we're still costing money.
Okay, let's not digress too far.
The important thing is you can buy land in Second Life. Hero's pals made a lot of money in real estate. This is why. Did Hero have a you store it in the metaverse?
No.
Nice what house. Is his house like in the metaverse?
It's just like he has a carp pond.
It was like a rice paper.
Except they weren't carpeted.
Normal house.
He would have been carpeted.
Well, Hero had a decent house. He had some decent digs in the metaverse. Jay mentioned earlier the class system. Did the class system in real life extrude into the metaverse?
Yeah.
How good of a hammer.
Let's talk about that. How did that happen? What would be? How do you see the extrusion or the parallels?
Your avatar would be different depending on what you could afford and what connection you had.
Well, on Wikipedia it says, for avatar, social status within the metaverse is often based on the quality of a user's avatar, as a highly detailed avatar showed that the user was a skilled hacker and programmer, while the less talented would buy off-the-shelf models in the same manner a beginner would today.
So what constituted the class difference if the outward manifestation of your avatar, a good programmer, made a cool avatar? And if you were on there are two dimensions to it. If you were on a public terminal, your avatar perhaps wasn't as good, which that was a piece of reality pushing itself into the metaverse. Talk about some of the differences in class in the metaverse versus the real world that they lived in the U-Store.
Possible move quicker.
Sorry, Matt.
Say it later.
Because, you know, some of the people could buy the off-the-shelf models. There was this upper class with the people who were rich, but it's not like hacking costs money.
Right.
So learning to hack, so there's a greater mobility between the social structure.
Is hacking skills, are they inherited?
No.
Are they passed down?
No.
Trust fund to trust fund?
No.
Where does one develop hacking skills?
Hanging out with hackers and just learning it by yourself.
Working.
So, one word for that is meritocracy.
Meritocracy.
I was getting there.
We knew you were right on top of it. Well, have a think on that for a second. We talked about the social differentiation. So you've got a world. Well, think about the context. Back up and think about the context. Government's gone. It's decentralized. It's outsourced to General Jim for your defense. There's Berkeley police. There's this homogenous middle class living behind gated communities. All those people then get level set and restarted when they hit the metaverse. When Hero was, did Hero come about 6 years into the metaverse's creation?
But
why? What's the significance in that?
He's one of the first people that bought real estate. Right?
Is that what? And where's there? Is there a pioneer?
Wasn't he one of the developers?
He helped build it. He created the sword fighting software.
So. And was there a monorail?
And his, like, and his like girlfriend made the face.
Go ahead.
Oh, and his girlfriend made one of the biggest impacts on the entire metaverse was the face recognition of Hill. That software is what actually created the meritocracy, because the basis is what, you know, separates the really accomplished program between the people.
So that manifestation of an individual skill applied to an avatar, was that a class differentiator within the metaverse? Mm-hmm. They wrote their software, right, when they first created the metaverse. You remember that section? The race, right? And they would race their software, right? So this shows that they conceived of a world, and they developed the world, But what did their life look like? What was Hero's reflection on the romantic state of affairs of his life at this point in the real world? Anybody want to comment on that?
Whenever he was writing girls. The software? Or
help me out with the question, Jay.
Are you talking about how he embellished his deliverator abilities? Or it seemed like I thought it was a little bit skewed how he emphasized how amazing it was to be a deliverator.
What I'm trying to get to is there's a point where Hero reflects on the romantic conception he had of his life, and he's at a different stage in his life now. Does he perceive his life to be as romantic as he thought it would be, being a freelance hacker? He just what happened to his job at as a deliverator?
That's gone, and he kind of resents being a freelance hacker because no one needs him anymore. Because you kind of see how he looks down on the conformity now. Hackers have become this
assembly line
of software engineers, and everything that he thought made him an original and individual is now standardized.
So, through that, I think Stevenson is capturing another development, which is that many people had utopian dreams for the internet. The internet did exist in a certain way in 92. Because of the development of various protocols from ARPA and through the 80s, for someone like Neal Stephenson, who was on the cutting edge of technology, he was exchanging emails. He was using Usenet and Telnet to pass files, very cumbersome, but nonetheless pass files to one to his friends on bulletin boards in the 80s. So he understood this. But what Professor Hall is driving at is how far-sighted he was in seeing that the utopian vision of the internet could be corrupted by corporate powers, by commercialization, by routinization, by all kinds of ills that were also affecting the real world. I mean, after all, if we talk about the withering away of the nation state, what nation are we talking about? This is not a hard question. The United States. You know, the United States. I mean, talk about the utopian impulses that go behind the creation of this United States. It's a pretty easy question, too. I think you probably are not answering because it's so obvious. So, what?
Sounds rhetorical.
It does sound rhetorical, but I want us to think about it by articulating it. And what are some of the utopian dreams that went into the founding of the United States?
Freedom,
democracy. What did you say about
equality?
Anything else? What did you say, Jeff?
Pursuit
of happiness. So, boy, pursuit of happiness may be even the most relevant of them all, because here's a world where pursuit of happiness has led to kind of anarchy. Yes.
Like freedom from taxes was almost one of the utopian dreams, not so much for the government, but everybody was thinking it.
Well, they got it in this metaverse, didn't they?
Yeah.
So, you know, if on the exterior world, in the real world, the real depicted world, the you store it world in Stevenson's book, the principles, the utopian principles of democracy, freedom, equality are being travestied. Some people retreated to the metaverse because in their idealism they're sitting there thinking, well, we'll start again, you know, we'll just make it all up in a virtual reality.
Commercialization of these spaces, the American dream, there was a blank space that we started from in the metaverse. Hero was a pioneer in that metaverse. As the metaverse grew, and there was a number that he gave at the time, so many millions and so many millions, and he profiled the demographics. Look at the reality of it up here on the one point, and I'm going to show you this, come back to this from time to time. There's over 1 billion people connected to the internet with various speeds and qualities. That's a pretty substantial number. You now have a market of 1 billion people to which certain folks want to pitch their goods. Chris mentioned it earlier, and we've all been victimized in our games, MMOs. How many people here have got gold spammed? I assume everybody. But we've all got gold spammed. Well, there is a target market. It's been commercialized. To me, that is an intrusion on the space. However, who's played racing games or like and really enjoyed racing games? Anybody? Ted? Peter?
Mario Kart.
Mario Kart. And I'm thinking more
you like Forza?
Simulation, like Gran Turismo. You know, these sort of more realistic games. That is one of the first places where you saw commercialization start to occur. It was very subtle. How did it manifest itself within those properties, you know?
Like on the racetrack advertisements around the borders of like the race, like, you know, how like in real races they'll advertise like beer or cigarettes or something. I don't think they're allowed to do that anymore.
Camel GT is a good example of a real world race.
But like in Gran Turismo, like Konami or whoever makes the game will advertise.
Yeah, Chris.
They also do it a lot in like FIFA, like along the
edges.
And this one MMO called Auto Assault. I don't know if anybody...
It's defunct now.
Yeah, it got discontinued. But they had advertisements in that. And you could also... Like, they had a competition for someone to create an advertisement. And whoever won, we get it on there.
Well, so you see this commercial...
I think Matt has his hand up.
And also, I mean, if you look at the old games, like F-Zero and the old NASCAR games, they didn't have name brands. It wasn't a Ferrari. It was just a look-alike. And now it actually is a Ferrari.
Modeled perfectly, right?
Games like Burnout now, though, they still rely on, like, you know, facsimiles of the real cars.
GTA
is
another one. They're still awesome.
Oh, yes. Well, I want you to think on this, is that this is not a unique phenomenon. Have you seen this in movies or television?
Yeah, viral marketing.
Wayne's
Well, Wesley, speak up there. I want to hit Wesley.
Product placement.
And then Matt?
Oh, I just said it's all viral marketing.
But product placement and viral marketing. Hold on the viral marketing, and I want to get to finish the product placement idea. If you watch 24 or any of these programs, one of the basic things that you see,
every single car is made by Ford until the recent season, which was Toyota.
It absolutely does. You can see it. And then suddenly they switch their whole fleet. You should see it in the X-Files, too. And the other thing is, I saw recently people switch from Apple to Dell in a program I watched on TV. I can't remember which one it was. I said, now they're using... Oh, Stargate. They were using, and now they're using Dell.
I see Apple in so many movies.
iRobot was just plagued with advertising. It was so blatant.
And like in Jurassic Park, that was the first one I remember. They always zoom in right on the Mercedes sign on all the front of every car.
Peter.
Well, I mean, it's cute when you can spot it, but the two worst symbols of Jurassic Park, it doesn't matter if, you know, the cars, it doesn't even matter if they're zooming in because it looks cool. It looks like an action shot. All right, Blade 3, she's in the back of her car uploading music with iTunes from her Mac onto her iPod Nano. Not only is she doing this, but they have a discussion about how easy it is for her to do this and how she likes to listen to her iPod while fighting vampires. And Collateral,
robots,
the movie Collateral with Jamie Foxx and Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
The top of the cab, just like all cabs have ads on top of them, is Bacardi. But every shot of the cab driving is like Bacardi on the bottom half and then the city line. It's just everywhere. You just see Bacardi the entire movie. Okay. It's just advertised.
I was going to say, in iRobot, you get the thing with the Converse.
Yes.
And it was on for like 10 minutes. And then they commented on it later in the movie. It's basically a giant ad for Converse.
But a true ad, they're mainly.
What about the Transformers? All of them were Chevy cars. And it was the introduction of the new Charger.
We're barraged by this, aren't we? There's nothing new under the sun. I want you to go back to that history.
Camaro, wasn't it?
Okay.
Yeah,
I want you guys to go back to the history of gaming discussion I had in my little cast. And in the 70s, in the 80s, in the early 90s, it was about independence. It was a time, and it's also the aging of hero protagonists, I think, goes with this as well. Independent individuals created major properties without the intrusion of commercialization. Well, guess what's happening? As heroes aging, the metaverse is maturing, and you're seeing a lot of that sort of intrusion. And then I want to start the whole core of the book. What is, I want to ask two questions and get the J's, we'll transfer over to the viral marketing component. What is Snow Crash? It's two things.
A book.
Okay, it's three things in it. It is a book. Watch Krista. Bring out the obvious here.
in early Apple computers, when you did something I guess you couldn't do, it would crash, and there would be a whole bunch of, like, it would snow, like fuzz that you see on TV when it breaks, but then I guess there would be letters or something.
Well, I live this, and we were Jay heard me and a couple of the other old IT nerds talking about in the 80s when we were programming in assembler. If you hit the wrong memory address on an Apple II, or an Apple II, the monitor was green, and you see this green and black phenomenon in the matrix, right? That's the kind of the color scheme. That matrix-like view of characters, if you peeked or poked in the wrong area of memory, it wouldn't fuzz out like that, but it would be all the random characters and suddenly machine lock. That's how Neal Stephenson characterizes Snow Crash. What else is Snow Crash inside of... looking at, that's exactly the way he characterized it, Matt. What else is Snow Crash in the book? It's a drug? Is it really a drug?
It's a virus.
It's like a virus.
Well, where do you catch it from?
The HyperCard.
Okay. I'm a few more bars on that guy.
It's also in the capsules, and at this point we don't know what is in the capsules, but right. We know it's something.
Is there a later reference in popular mainstream film to a capsule?
The Matrix.
Yeah.
Which pill do you want to take? So, this is the virus, and we want to discuss, and we're going to allow Professor Clayton to jump in here on his viral discussion. The Snow Crash is then a virus, and how does one contract the virus? What do you have to do?
You have to rip open the card.
So you actually have to
He has to look at the binary, because he was talking about how our brain has those nerves for the binary.
And is that even conceivable that we could... have you ever been so engrossed in a game that you had a physiological reaction to it afterwards?
I've gotten angry at a game.
So you had an emotional reaction, which is manifested physically.
You. Seth was so pissed off.
So have you guys ever had a reaction where you really get in it?
The Knights of the Old Republic won. The twist. It was amazing. I was stuck.
That guy's jumping under a bus.
Oh.
Okay, Matt, how do I get to, how do I search on YouTube for a history of gaming?
Just go type Matthew Jett Hall, one word. See if that comes up on the list. No, one word, no dot. That's my account.
I think that's right. I think that'll do it.
And if you can get to there, you should be able to, there you go. And then down at the bottom, there's a bunch of links.
Yeah, but where was the Vanderbilt side?
Well, we're fine. There it is. There's the two. Yeah.
Okay. I just wanted to bring this up. On YouTube right now, good Lord.
God, I hope the Lord will fast forward that.
On YouTube right now, this course has quite a prominence with Matt Hall's history and chronology of the influences of video games. So, so
I even got the semester wrong.
So let's sort of stop. We'll just stop it right there. I didn't want to.
I think Jay's doing viral marketing. So, Professor Clay, did you want to talk about the virus?
I actually don't think we ought to talk about the virus right now because the really interesting discussions about the way virus works occur in the 200s, page 200s onward in the book, and keep alert to all the different ways Neal Stephenson thinks through the question of virus. But I did want to just talk about the basic analogy about what is the basic analogy? It's really obvious in the use of the word virus in this book.
An infection that spreads, infectious,
yes.
Contagious.
Contagious in what realms?
And then you can spread it to other animals.
What?
Like all of them.
Ultimately, all of them.
Okay, while we're on that, can we use this context for the spread vectors?
Why don't you?
Well, there's always a ground zero of a contagion, right? So there was always a first, whether it was Ebola or the cold, whatever the virus is, there's going to be a first. If a person in Uganda and a person in Albuquerque, separated by distance, a person in Uganda catches a virus, dies without ever coming into contact with another human being, can it be transmitted?
No.
The body disintegrates, it's burned for all the lawyers in the group. It's just gone.
No.
Can Probably not, right? What causes a virus to propagate?
Contact. Interaction.
Contact. This is a map on up here of the real internet, different colors, and you can it's in our class supplemental materials list. You can go look at it online yourselves. Each one of those colors represent a .com, a .mil, a .gov. This was only 30% of the internet in January 2005. If that were the metaverse in Neal Stephenson's world, and Snow Crash were to propagate out of control of the people in the metaverse, what would happen from that?
Everything would be infected.
Everything intersects on it, so everything would spread to everything else.
But it's not really a virus, which is a weapon. Because when David gets Snow Crash, he just goes off the metaverse, and you don't know what happens to him. But it was, I guess we now know that it's Raven, I guess, who did it, who gave him the card. And so, like, he's just handing it out, and then if you take it and you read it, you crash. But it's not really like if you see a crash person, you also crash. You have to take the card, and you have to read the card.
So you take it, but you're taking it from someone, right?
Yes, but it's more like a...
And there's no one else distributing it?
A gun rather than a...
No one else is distributing Snow Crash, just Raven.
I mean, not that we know. He just knows, like...
Not yet. I mean, we're okay. Early in the book. Gotcha. That's the problem of having this... So, did you have a slide of the internet in 97?
Well, they'll have this visual representation, but what we have is...
I still don't get what that picture was.
Okay, let me go back to Daniel's question here. This is actually, if I can find the bloody photo, there it is. This is each individual dot, and there's thousands upon thousands upon thousands of dots making this up. There's a hub and spoke system. Every single dot is an IP address on the internet. That's our street address on the internet. So this was a map that was computer generated in 2005, January, of what 30% of the internet looked like if it was mapping out. There was an internet geography, internet topography movement that tried to visualize the number of nodes on the internet. And this is that spread and how vast it is and how many things. It shows the interconnectedness, and the colors represent the type of domains, whether it's a .com, a government, an educational, a military website.
And how do they determine, like, how far apart the dots are?
Geographically, based upon the IP addresses, I can tell you where you are in the world based upon what router you're connected to. That's how I can find you guys when you file share. I know exactly what room the traffic's coming from.
That's creepy.
But it's real, and that's real in the real world, too. It's not just a Vanderbilt.
But don't they have IP spoofers where you can, like, get most away from that and, like, present a false IP address?
You can try.
Well, I mean, I'm pretty sure that's how it's
IT. Yeah. Do you feel lucky? Throw down the
gauntlet. Do you feel lucky? Yeah, there are people who try to IP spoof, but I think Jeff said it. The technology is getting to such that you have multivariate authentication. So you can really get down to determining where people are. And based upon the IP addresses that are issued by ICANN, I-C-A-A-N, you know geographically where people are. So a certain domain address is attached to a certain physical address, you can isolate it.
Yeah, but I feel that, like, as with anything, as the enforcement of it gets better, the people who are breaking the enforcement get better, and you just go back and forth with that cycle.
That's one theory. I don't think it's so true as it relates to IP spoofing. Mm-hmm. It's certainly true with Nutella and LimeWire, as an example, but it's not the case with IP spoofing.
Just like
that's an older tech.
But bacteria, how our new strains are being formed because we have so many antibiotics and stuff.
It's kind of weapons of mass destruction. I'm going to build my weapons, you're going to build your weapons, and we're going to keep leapfrogging each other, right? Mutually assured destruction is the doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
But by and large, we can, at least on that, we can map and predict. Daniel, that's where the goal of that illustration is. Professor?
Just by coincidence, I'm reading the book. This for another part of my job as an English professor, and this book's called Cinematic Prophylaxis, Globalization and Contagion in the Discourses of World Health. It's written by Kirsten Osper. And part of this book is about the change in understandings of viral contagion from the 1950s and today. And she references early in her book a public education film from the 1950s about how you spread the flu, you know, and it has a very nicely dressed 1950s mother of a small child going to tea with one of her friends and then coughing or sneezing once. And from there, this 50s public health film shows the rapid spread of it. And here is the illustration of viral contagion in the 1950s. What's the difference there? I heard you laughing, Mike.
It's like a straight line across the country.
That's right. Of individuals spreading it and then bumping into another individual. And that illustration had the node idea right, that each person would then become a node of new contagion. But they hadn't kind of wrapped their mind around network theory then. You know, network theory is a very recent development in mathematics and computer sciences and a lot of domains to think about new ways of interconnectivity, and particularly prominent in media studies, where with the advent of the internet, we have a different relationship to communication. Now, the internet was created originally by ARPA, which later became DARPA, Defense Army...
Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency.
Just say that again, I didn't...
Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency.
That's right. And the original purpose of developing such a distributed network of communication where it was not designed as a one-to-many distribution network the way broadcast communication is. The original purpose was to have a communication system that would not go down in the event of a nuclear attack. That if a nuclear attack hit one major node in a centralized communications network, total end of communication. So the internet is designed so that if you create a message, it breaks it up into tiny packets and slings them out into the internet, scattershot, and each packet finds its own way to the destination, so that, you know, I can send Matt an email from my office and it can be routed, a little packet of it could be routed through Omaha and another packet go through Mexico City and all reassemble in an instant at his computer, so that knocking out one node wouldn't knock it out all. But how does that change when you've got a world that interconnected? How does that change one's relationship to virus?
It spreads so much faster. Because instead of just being connected to, like, say, instead of us just being connected, you know, 15 people in here, now connected to a million people around the world. And if one of them's infected, he spreads it to the million people he's connected to, rather than the 15 in the room.
You have a thought, Chris?
Well, if it was, like, centralized, then if the virus infected the center, then obviously we get to everything else.
Do you ever see that in movies?
Oh, yes. There's one we're going to watch, I believe.
Right. But, I mean, did you see V for Vendetta? Yeah. You know. So what kind of greatest movie ever we have said? V for Vendetta. I want to get you... First of all, I want to give you the word dystopia. Dystopia, the opposite of utopia. I want to give you then two different kinds of dystopia. V for Vendetta is one kind of dystopia, particularly in relation to communications technology. What kind of, how would you describe the dystopia in V for Vendetta? Yes, Setha.
So all media is controlled.
Controlled by how many places?
One.
Centralized. What classic novels? 1984. Any others? Not as much in Brave New World, but 1984 is the canonical instance of a dystopia conceived around a totalitarian centralization of communication, so that it sent
the same message on all bands out to everyone. But of course, how do you fight that? Matt, it's your greatest movie ever. How do you fight it?
Fight
a centralized totalitarian
bombs on
control.
A
trailer.
Blow things up.
You have to get the people blow. Who are controlling.
How many? Do you have to get all those people?
Just one.
Decentralized. Right. So, how does that change plot, for example?
You can centralize around one person.
I mean, it's a simple plot. It's good. One good guy against the masked state power.
Speaking truth to power.
Right, speaking truth to power. We got, you know, fight.
Apple versus IBM. Barack versus Hillary.
Frozen forehead.
What? Barack versus Hillary. That's an amazing t-shirt.
So another thing that a viral conception of communication does is change your platform of your dystopia. You know, you have a really dramatically different situation where where power is decentralized and dispersed through burbclaves and through transnational corporations with no single centralized government. And another kind, and so how would you fight that? Well, you'll find out.
Yeah.
In our next episode.
In our next episode.
But I do want to emphasize what Chris said. Centralization, if you have that single node, it can be taken down. We're gonna be going through Tron and then within the next few weeks, I believe.
Yes, I think so.
And there is something in Tron called the Master Control Program. And we'll be seeing how that centralization can be toppled.
Other comments?
Just starting with 1984. What? That was a centralized system, but it doesn't really exactly end with the...
with him taking it down, does it?
Yeah, it ends with him realizing that the centralized government is really the way to go, and now it's the best system ever.
You can look for us.
It's a happy ending. Yeah, it's great. Thanks for all the nice comments.
It's a spoiler. Spoiler alert.
Too late. Well, we do have a couple more minutes, and I'd like to use them to just talk about some other aspects of the opening of this novel. One thing we haven't talked about is we talked a little bit about class. What about race in this book? Yes, Seth.
Here is an example.
Speak up.
I'm not sure what Asian country. It's not different.
Korean.
Black. And YT, is she Asian?
She's
Caucasian because she went into the Caucasian community or whatever.
Yeah, but she said she had visas for everywhere, so.
But she was, I promise.
What?
She wasn't.
Yeah, I do remember saying something.
She was what?
She was, I promise.
Max.
Okay.
Max, I've
read ahead.
Well, every bird wave or like organization pretty much has its own race and its. Racism is really rampant in the society. There are white supremacist birdwaves, and also like when they're escaping, when he breaks her out of the clink.
Greater Hong Kong.
Yeah, they just can't escape to anywhere. They have to go to a place that will be accepting of both black, Korean mix, and white at the same time, which was hard to find.
That's really, really great comment. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, just, when the mafia guy is talking to Jason about, he said he was going to go interview at Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong. That part was, and he's like, I'm not, you know, don't take this as a racist statement, because I'm not a racist, but.
But, and then he spews.
Japs.
And then he spews racist.
Especially when he gets in New South Africa.
So what do you think Neal Stephenson's attitude towards race is in this book? Can you extrapolate from this world that we've described as one of apartheid, you use that word, a segregation into intensely racist communities? What's Neal Stephenson trying to say about race?
That's still a big issue?
Well, I feel like...
More than that. Still a big issue.
I'm not sure if his book is, you know, completely dystopian or utopian. I can't really get the feel on how much he is against everything he writes about in this book.
That is a really important question.
He's
is how to assess the attitude the author wants us to take toward the material that he's showing us. And that's where real critical intelligence has to come into play. You can't be sure without a lot of analysis all the time whether this is a critique of racism, whether later in the book there may be things that are disturbing about race, whether he is advocating the metaverse or whether he's showing the problems with it. Max, you've waited patiently.
I was just going to say that, I don't know, a major element of the book is how the government has been sort of decentralized and doesn't really have much power, and I guess what I thought he was saying is when left up to their own devices, people sort of do what they want if they're not regulated by society or central government, and like if they feel racist, they'll group with other races, form a bird clave, or basically sort of unregulated.
That's a very eloquent statement that we ought to end on, Chris.